It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Natural Resources Defense Council, it describes biophilia as the innate human instinct to connect with nature and other living beings. As we spend about 90% of our life indoors, we learn how to incorporate nature into our spaces. Call in with questions and comments about biophilic design, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie Ryan Balogtas is an environmental design consultant focused on biophilic design, is project director at the New York design firm Terrapin Bright Green. Katie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with what sets biophilic design apart. How is it different from other types of design, say environmental design?
Well, it's actually often mistaken as a type of design, but really it's more of a mindset or a source of inspiration and knowledge. So environmental design is traditionally thought of as like the condition of the soil or, you know, other characteristics that are required to be measured in order to get a building permit, or maybe the condition of the river. But when you talk about biophilic design, it's really about connecting to that land rather than critiquing the biological condition of it and trying to fix that. So from a design standpoint, if you think about architecture or product design or even fabric design or some other aspect of our built environment, even the planning of cities, it's more about what we can learn from nature and the experiences we have within nature and how they influence our design decisions to create healthy, comfortable spaces that we protect and that we love over time.
I wonder then how it connects with like green building, you know, and LEED certification and things like that, whereas, you know, we're really trying to think about climate change and the climate environment around us as we make those building choices.
It's a great question. I think biophilic design in recent years has kind of been where, say, green building was about 20 years ago, where it was, you know, it sounded kind of nice, but, you know, who's going to pay for it? And it, is there, you know, evidence that it really is going to work? So for the last few years, we've been getting over that hump with biophilic design. And so I would say that it supports or is kind of in parallel with the whole green building movement. But the green building movement is largely, or at least traditionally, has been focused on the performance of the building to benefit cost and environmental conditions. So not doing harm to water or improving the air quality or reducing the energy bill. But biophilic design is really about the experience of the place. So it's more about the people, how we are designing those very green buildings or not so green buildings to support health and well-being in the space, whether it's in the building or on the street looking at the building. So it's much more about the people in relation to nature.
How does the space in homes or at work affect a person's mood? What is that connection like?
Well, there's a huge range of impacts. They're primarily discussed in terms of physiological health, cognitive performance, and maybe our psychological or mental well-being, including mood or emotion. But more specifically, it could be anything from stress reduction, like including our systolic blood pressure or cortisol levels, which can have, you know, this domino effect on other health conditions. But it also can affect our, you know, our vision, our visual acuity, like how well we see what's in front of us, our sleeping patterns, attention, creativity, even decision-making and problem-solving. It just really depends on how you look at biophilic design. And then I'd say, like, there's also our perception of calm and comfort and safety, or even perceptions of time and place. And then finally, I'd say that another big area of health impact would be prosocial behaviors, like our perception of self in the grand scheme of things, generosity, humility. So you can see that there's this huge range of potential impacts. And so with biophilic design, it's looking at the science and understanding what are your design priorities, like what are the experience or the health outcomes that you want for the people you're designing for, and then choosing based on the science and nature, like what makes the most sense for what you're the experience you're trying to create.
Almost feels like a holistic approach, almost a way of life, if you will.
Well, yeah, I mean, I try to think of it holistically, especially when you're talking about green building, because there's a lot of choices that we make in green building that have already been like financially justified or is a priority for the client or whether the client is a building owner or the government, in that, you know, a lot of those decisions about like keeping the electricity bill low, so having good daylight, well, that's both an energy decision, but it's also a health and well-being decision. So how do we think more holistically about design to support both the bottom line and our health and well-being?
Katie Ryan Balogtas, environmental design consultant specializing in biophilic design. You can join in with your questions and comments about designing interior spaces that affect mood and many other things. 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. So, Katie, are there some tips or pointers? How can someone design a space with this mindset, with this holistic nature in mind? Like, you know, what is that approach to design like?
Sure. I mean, there's a couple different angles. So if you're starting from scratch, you have perhaps more opportunity. And then the earlier you think about it, the better chance you are to be able to integrate your ideas in. Mm. But if you're just talking about how to make an existing space a little better, you know, it can start off a little bit more biophilic, I should say. You can be looking at your lighting fixture, making it more like an organic design or something that reflects light on the walls in a fun or fractal way, to your choice of upholstery. If there's a pattern, either like something very literal, like the leaf patterns, or maybe it's more abstract, but it has a less geometrical, like forced design, and something that's a little bit more reflective of something that happens in nature. So, you know, patterns, selection of material, like wood surfaces or even a wood structure of a building that is exposed. So you see the wood, you see the grain. So it's really about what you see and touch, the multisensory experience. And then if you're talking about how you orient a building or orient your landscape design or your garden, it's like, what can you see? How do you see through the space? How does the air flow through the space? Is it natural and kind of staggered and not something that you can anticipate? So there's some variability to it.
Well, things like classrooms or hospital hallways, some cubicles that, you know, lack windows. How can you use these visual cues in spaces like that when they lack windows?
That's a great question, because a lot of those spaces used to have windows before the advent of electricity and air conditioning. But we did away with it either for cost, or just, you know, didn't seem necessary at the time. But there's also some misperception of what that experience actually entails. Like windows in schools were often eliminated, if not for cost, then because they were considered a distraction to students. But that has been since proven to not necessarily be true. Depends on what's going on outside. But often research shows that kids that see a view to nature outside are actually going to be more relaxed and focused and do better on their testing and be able to retain more, have better memory than kids who don't have a window or who don't have, or have like too much stuff on the wall that's a distraction from the window. So there are some spaces that are easier to, you know, adapt, like putting a new window in a public school is going to be tricky. So in that case, creating alternative spaces for, say, kids or whomever to spend in or connected to nature will be perhaps the most cost-effective and health-impactful way to address that disconnection from nature. So having schoolyards that are very vegetated, or encourage getting your hands dirty and learning in nature and playing in nature, cognitive development is going to be much stronger for those young kids with that experience than in a more, you know, restricted schoolyard.
Katie Ryan Balogtas, environmental design consultant specializing in biophilic design. Call with your questions and comments about nature-inspired interior design, what it means to you, what it does for you. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore how biophilic design invites natural elements into architecture. Of course, a nod to Wisconsin's native son, architect Frank Lloyd Wright, who believed nature was an inspirational force. Call in with questions about bringing natural lights and plants and water into living space. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie Ryan Balogtas is an environmental design consultant with expertise in biophilic design. Stays with us. Katie, what about Frank Lloyd Wright? You know, how influential is Wright's design in the biophilic movement?
Actually, I don't think a lot of people talk about him as inspiration, but those people who are well-versed in biophilia or just have been involved in the conversation recognize his work as really foundational to how we think about nature in or nature of the space, which is, you know, really those physical or spatial considerations on how the building works. And then, of course, a lot of his places are have wonderful landscapes and views. So there are multi dimensions to how he has influenced how we think about building and home design. Let me see some examples I can.
Falling water in Pennsylvania, you know, built partly over a waterfall, I would imagine is an example.
That is an example, and it's probably one of, like, it's just a very obvious one.
Yes, yes.
But that's also, you know, you have the benefit of a wonderful landscape to begin with.
Right.
But some of his designs, some of his buildings and interiors aren't necessarily dependent upon being in this fantastic natural environment. And not everyone has the benefit of that at their disposal, right? He has other examples that I think are really reflective of the period in which he's working in. Like some of his buildings directly affect his mood, his professional or personal state of being at the time, you know, whether his professional state is like he's at the top of his game, or if personal things have happened with his family. Like you can see that reflected in some of his buildings, whether there's a lot of refuge, like small dark spaces, versus very open and lots of views, or even risk elements like bird walks out above, you know, above a ravine or a river. So those are spatial characteristics that are very critical to that connection with nature. One of the reasons that we like things like risk and that the mystery of experiencing those spaces is that it releases dopamine. And so there's that pleasure response we get from things like risk. So standing over the waterfall is very exciting for us. But he also he's designed very different spaces, like the Johnson Wax Administrative Building in Racine. It's one of my favorites to talk about from a biophilic design perspective. And you wouldn't necessarily, like at first look at it, it doesn't seem biophilic because it has no plants in it, like so, and there's no views, there's no windows. So why is it biophilic? There's three main reasons that I like to refer to this project is that the most obvious, I suppose, would be that on the interior, you have these really tall tree-like columns sprinkled throughout the work area. And so, and then there's this light that kind of electric light above the trees. So it kind of is like you're in a forest with the light shining through. The other reason is that when you're entering the building from the parking area, the ceilings are really low. It's a very like compressed space. And so that feeling of compression brings you through to the main, the center of the building where it opens up and suddenly the ceilings get really high and there's this sense of release from the space. So that compression release, you're getting the prospect and refuge, but you're also inducing a sense of awe. Like, have you ever walked into a cathedral or gone to the edge of the Grand Canyon or at the top of a waterfall? Like, you get this sense of like amazement, and maybe you pause, your jaw drops, your eyes open, and you're kind of in this different state of being. So those are two main reasons, like biophilic qualities to that space, to the Johnson Wax building. But another really key point here is that that building has not been remodeled since it was originally built. And I can't think of another office building that has not undergone major renovation in 70 years. Like, it's almost unheard of. And so there's this point that like designing biophilic spaces that are truly embracing the concepts of nature, spatially or otherwise, are places that people love and they want to take care of. And so they last a lifetime or longer. And that's not pretty typical practice in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Like, we tend to build for the short term, and it's all about return on investment and that initial investment cost. And it's not really thinking about that love
generations.
Of play.
Yes.
And that the fact that health and well-being, like designing for health and well-being, is a long-term investment. So it's really hard to quantify when you're doing that initial cost, when you're purchasing the concrete and you're, you know, outfitting it with this furniture, that furniture, you're thinking 10 years maybe. In some cases you might be thinking a little longer, but it's not really factoring in the actual impact to the people who use the space, whether they're office workers or family members or hospital patients, like thinking about it long term. Like, what does that really mean?
I just want to pause right there with Katie Ryan Balogtas and take a call. Angela in Partyville is here. Angela, hi.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to, for Christmas, my brother gave me some plants that they must have wrapped the dirt in moss and then a wire mesh. And then they hang on a piece of wood on the wall, like you just hook it onto the nails. And then you take it off once a week and water it and then let it dry a little bit and put it back. And it just makes it feel so much like the greenery is in our space much more than a plant in a pot.
Angela, thank you. Katie, what about that approach?
I think that's fantastic. You know, one of the things that we emphasize is that it's not just about plants. However, it can be really effective to have a few plants in your space. It completely transforms it, especially when there is a care factor, when you need to take care of it, you can love it, you can respect it, but it changes the atmosphere. And it also changes your attention. Having those plants on the wall, having light stream through them, it changes the experience of the space over the course of the day or even the course of the year. And so you're going to be more aware of it than had it not been, you know, had it just been a potted plant on the ground or, you know, tucked away or outside. So I think it's wonderful that you've, adopted that and that you are caring for it. Caring for plants is a really great way to stay connected with nature. But there's a lot of other benefits associated with caring for plants. It's good for arthritis. It's good for your like the non-visual connection, like the smell of the soil is actually can be quite healthy as well. Being it, you know that smell after it rains outside?
Yes.
Yeah. Petrichor.
Yes.
It's actually really rejuvenating. So, you know, walking outside in nature after it rains or watering your plants and keeping that moisture, like it's there's something to do. Yeah.
Katie Ryan Balogtas with us as we talk about biophilic design, 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore biophilic design that seeks to boost our connection to nature and natural elements like daylight and plants, water and exposed wood, as we spend so much of our time indoors. Bring your questions and comments about arranging living spaces to be more attuned to nature, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie Ryan Balogtas is an environmental design consultant who specializes in biophilic design. Katie, we might assume that biophilic design is just plain old expensive, that prioritizing well-being in a design will just cost more. How affordable is it to incorporate biophilic designs into a home?
It's an understandable misconception because it's fairly new to our terminology and our the way we approach design projects. But the reality is that in most cases, for most types of biophilic design or most interventions, you're making those decisions anyway. It's whether you're using biophilic design to direct or filter your design choices. When we talk about biophilic design at the design table, it's usually in three categories. There's nature in the space, which really talks about the physical and experiential or ephemeral qualities of the space, like water and plants and airflow and light. Whereas there's also natural analogs. So then you get into the materials and the shapes and patterns. And then the third area is the nature of the space, which we've spoken of just quite a bit today already, is the spatial qualities. So that prospect and refuge and views and things like that. So those spatial ones are going to be really critical to incorporate in the beginning of your design, because those, when you're talking about heights of ceilings or, those views out the window or through a space, those can have large architectural implications. But some of the other ones can actually come along at any time in the design or even be introduced after you're already using the space. And so when you're selecting a material or when you're selecting a wall covering or curtains or upholstery or furniture, it often is something you were already going to do. You're already going to have a couch or throw pillows. You're already going to have a wall or a window treatment, whether it's curtains or blinds. So why not make that choice something that is biophilic? So in that sense, it can have almost no impact and potentially even save, depending on what your options are, money. So in that sense, there is no cost implication.
Were there more biophilic interventions in the pandemic? I mean, was there a resurgence that you saw in biophilic design in the pandemic?
Yes. There's certainly a heightened interest. Mental health became much more or much less taboo to talk about. I mean, it had been leading up to the pandemic, but even more so in the pandemic. And so this recognition, both to be have spaces that you are comfortable in and that you can stay in for during lockdown, but also that ability to get outside and to go into a park those two, like what's going on in your home and then where, like how accessible those parks are. And at one point they closed the parks in many places, but then there was a fight with some doctors and researchers and professionals recognizing that how important it was for people to get outside, not just because you didn't have the quality. If you have poor air circulation in a space, you know, you could, COVID could actually circulate better, but also just being outside, you're connected to the time of day, the air quality, the plants. And so in both sense, people became aware, like, if I can't be outside all the time, how do I bring nature into my space? And so there was also this investment in space rather than travel. So people were renovating their homes or their backyards. And so biophilia really surged in interest
I bet it was like maybe an aha moment. Like, I wonder, how did you respond as a designer in a design firm?
Well, initially I was skeptical because I really didn't believe that they would adopt it while it was necessary and then be like, okay, well, the pandemic's over. That isn't important anymore. I was curious to see how long it would persist, this interest or renewed interest in this connection with nature. And I don't know what's happening at the home, like the residential level. I don't tend to work on the single family homes. But certainly within the workplace, as a way to both create healthy workplaces, but also encourage people to come back to the office. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we make our offices more appealing as a destination? Because some companies are just desperate to get people back in the office, even if it's not back in the office every day. So they're rethinking how the office is designed, but they're also supporting work from home. So, I know of some companies that are encouraging people at home to think about how their desk is oriented, you know, what they see, like, can they see out the window? Do they have breaks in the middle of the day for them to go enjoy nature? So there's much more transparency and flexibility in our choices, to support the mental health and to support other aspects of our health and well-being, not just the mental. But, you know, because companies want you to perform, whether they measure productivity or if it's just general performance and your workplace or remote workplace satisfaction and your loyalty to the company, they want to retain you. So how do we support our remote workers in the best way we can? And one of those is to, you know, provide or guidance, if not even a budget, for ensuring that your at-home workplace is more biophilic.
Katie Ryan Balogtas with us as we talk about how spaces evoke emotion and biophilic design. She's an environmental design consultant in New York. You can join in with your questions and your comments about biophilic design in your own spaces, in your workplaces, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Katie, here we are in Wisconsin with more than 14 million acres of farmland in our state as of 2021. Do corn or wheat fields, crop fields have biophilic aspects?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there's a huge culture around that type of agriculture. And so that it's a connection to place. So I don't think, if you were to Google or like just go online and look for biophilic design, the examples you get would be, you'd likely get a lot of vegetation and be tropical.
tropical lush.
Yes. And you're like, sure, that's really biophilic. But if the intent is to connect people to place for stewardship, for just love of place and other benefits, recognizing your local culture and climate and ecosystems is going to be equally important, if not more important. And seasonality is part of that. So there's seasons when things are cut down or trimmed or harvested and other times when they're not, when they're covered with snow or when they're covered in wildflowers that then die, you know, a month or week or day later, you know, that is just part of, that's a connection to natural systems. And that is really important for stewardship.
You mentioned materials and patterns. Can you go into that a little bit more, how they influence or involve biophilic design?
Yeah, absolutely. And that actually circles back to this, the idea of cornfields or what other industry might be common in that region. It's that materials that evoke local place, like wood that's sourced locally and ideally manufactured locally, when you start getting into sustainability or carbon footprint, things like that, you know, that local is good. But this is how biophilia ties into sustainability as well, or green building. So when you're choosing materials for a design, whether it's for interior design or architecture or your terrace or patio, thinking about something that is locally sourced can really help both connect you to place, but also give you some sort of restorative experience. The one thing that is really fantastic about wood is that the grain within wood, that you can see the grain, those lines that kind of, they're not totally straight, but they're all more or less parallel, whether they're waving or straight. Those are fractal in characteristic. And from the research, we understand that fractal patterns and just the collinear patterns are really easy for us to process because we've, for millennia, been experiencing them in nature. So when we see them in products like wood, we know exactly what it is. It brings a sense of comfort. Our prefrontal cortex in our brain calms down and we're able to relax mentally, restore. And so it reduces fatigue. And that's not a process that we're conscious of. It just happens naturally. And so choosing wood with a really nice pattern grain or a live edge, you know, raw edge wood for a tabletop. And, you know, that can be considered trendy, but in fact, there's actually a real health benefit to it as well.
I'm going to just pause right there. Environmental design consultant Katie Ryan Balogtas with us, our guide to the intersection of nature and architecture. Still time to bring up your questions about biophilic design, 800-642-1234 to join in. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What if our homes could evoke the same feeling as being outdoors? The environmental design is called biophilic. Join in with how you bring the natural world into your living space, how it makes you feel. 800-642-1234. Katie Ryan Balogtas is an environmental design consultant specializing in biophilic design and stays with us. Let's bring on Courtney in Barneveld. Courtney, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
So we built our house with whole trees timber, and if you don't mill a log, then the grain's actually stronger, and it's also nice because you have whole trees in your living space. It's nice to look at. But the building code, the state building code, doesn't allow for whole trees to be used in framing unless you have a special approval from an architect or an engineer. So I'm wondering if Katie can comment on the use of whole trees. It's, you know, obviously more environmentally friendly to just cut down a tree and use it in your building. And in the same way, also like cob and straw clay, those kind of things, it's just hard to get through the code. Thank you.
Courtney, thank you. Katie, what about building code here?
That is tricky, particularly because it's different everywhere. So it's harder to just say, well, it was done in California or is done in, you know, South Dakota, so why can't we do it here? I do agree with you that the whole, like, less processed, it's more cost effective, it's more biophilic, and it creates a great connection and ownership over your design. And so I fully encourage it. But building code can be a non-starter. So my first recommendation, if you haven't done it already, is to find out if there are other buildings in your district or region that have done it before. If you can find other examples of it being passed or permission granted, you might be able to skirt that, that getting a sign off from an architect or an engineer.
Courtney, what workarounds did you use in your design?
So I actually just Googled Whole Trees because I knew there's a company in Madison called Whole Trees Design, and they led me to the architect who started Whole Trees. His name is Roald Gunderson, and he actually pro bono helped us design our house, and he was the person that basically looked at the diameter of the trees and how many trees or logs we needed for the floor joists or the rafters or whatever. And so he would approve that. So you just need somebody that knows like what diameter and how many logs to use or how many trees to use. And so then he just like basically approved the design for through the inspector. The inspector just needed his like engineer number, architect number.
Wow. Courtney, thank you for that insight. Needing someone with that expertise in your corner, Katie.
Yeah, it's it is tricky, and it's great that you had that resource. I've worked on projects where you have extremely well-funded and well-known organizations that want to build a wooden structure, and the local departments won't allow it, and then so they have to go find, you know, examples of where it's been done before, and then convince them that the height and the materials are, you know, not going to be, fire retardant, all these other challenges that we're just not, I think we're in a culture of having to prove that it's been done before, even when it hasn't been done before. And so it's kind of an ongoing battle. So what I would say is if you had a good experience and it worked well, write about it, tell people, let people know that there are ways that, to share that knowledge, because we want to encourage people to adopt similar practices, both for environmental reasons, but also for love of place and for your, home experience.
In general, are building codes keeping up with biophilic design?
I wouldn't say they have. Many are still trying to understand how to adopt green development or sustainable development in a way that everyone can generally agree on. Mm-hmm. So you know how in some cities or states it may or may not be required, or it may be disallowed, to follow a green building rating system. So that's still a struggle in many places. In our national capital, it's actually any new building is required to be, LEED Gold, if I'm not mistaken. So there is progress. There's many other cities that may have that kind of requirement. Maybe it's focused on resilience. Maybe it's focused specifically on energy performance. But with respect to biophilic design, it's actually worked its way into the green building rating standards like LEED or WELL Building. So I think it's more suited to having to being integrated into other existing systems. Otherwise, it becomes a checklist. Hmm. And biophilia and health and well-being is not about a checklist. It's not always quantifiable. It's very qualitative. And so we want to avoid this checklist mentality, because otherwise, it's not being designed for the purpose. It's just saying, are there plants? Yes, check. Okay, we got that. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you're offering a biophilic experience. Just because it has something doesn't make it so. So we have to ask ourselves, why are we doing this? What is the experience of it? And I would say a really good example is when you see an advertisement for a company that has a beautiful green wall in the lobby of the building.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a PR piece. It's mm-hmm. how they're marketing. It has nothing truly to do with the health and well-being of the people in it, because you need to be able to experience the green, like to view it from, say, your desk. But if the only time you view it is when you're leaving the building or you're before you get in the elevator, that's not really giving you the opportunity to connect with it.
I want to just touch down here in a moment. The International Biophilic Summit taking place online, including experts from around the world. You're a jurist on this summit. How
yes.
expansive is the biophilic movement around the world?
It's actually quite expansive. And this summit is a new initiative. So there's other ones that have been around globally for several years. And so the Biophilic Cities Network is probably the most international, and it really works with governments to identify opportunities within their city to improve the biophilic conditions or quality of that city. And so each city might have different focus, and that's fine. So, but they all come together on this platform, Biophilic Cities Network. But then there's also the International Living Future Institute, and that's focused more on the individual buildings. They do some community work, but it's primarily on the buildings and the interiors.
Hmm.
And then you have platforms like this summit in Europe. It's based out of Italy, but it's all Europe. And then also, you know, has reaches into other parts of the world, but they are looking more broadly, not just architecture, but also photography, fashion, artificial intelligence, and product design, you know, anything you can think of, really. It's just trying to, there are people who are already doing this, and many people design biophilic, they use biophilic design instinctively, and they don't even call it that.
Hmm. Wow.
Right. So this is really, biophilic design is really just, it's a language for having a conversation.
And it's all around us. Katie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Katie Ryan Balogtas, an environmental design consultant specializing in biophilic design, director of projects at Terrapin Bright Green. That's a New York environmental design firm. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.